This is Made Fresh, a podcast hosted by Maggie Batista and Lee Belanger.
On this podcast, we share fresh takes and different ideas on work, relationships, culture, and more. And food is central to the story.
I'm Maggie Batista, a cookbook author, writer, marketing strategist, coach, and event designer.
And I'm Lee Belanger, a cookbook author, writer and editor, and content and program strategist.
We're so glad you're here.
So Maggie and I have been talking about privilege a lot, like a whole lot, over the past few weeks as we've been preparing for this episode. And when it comes to privilege, there are all kinds, right? Racial, class, gender, sexuality. But we thought that even though all of those types of privilege tend to intersect, it would be like a whole lot to unpack in one conversation. So we're just going to start with race. So I'm white. I identify as a progressive, a feminist, an anti-racist, but I also know that I benefit in like very deep and distinct ways from structural racism. Maggie's Latina. She has a different background than I do and a complicated relationship to whiteness, which we'll get into. So while we want to talk about some of that stuff today, we also want to talk about how we act on our responsibility as women with a significant amount of privilege. Hi, Maggie. How's it going today?
It's okay. I mean, it's good. I mean, I want to be upbeat, but there are Border Patrol agents intentionally running migrants over at the border, and I think that's really tough, especially in light of what we're talking about today. So I'm not happy about it. I don't think I need to fake that, at least for this episode. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't think we ever need to fake our feelings about stuff like that. I totally feel what you mean.
What about you? So how are you feeling today? I know you had said your cooking mojo came back a little. What have you been making?
Yeah, it has. I'm feeling pretty good on the personal level. With the bigger picture, I'm feeling very WTF. I've been talking with one friend a lot lately about our kids and YouTube. So they both like to make silly videos and put them up there. And while we want to like honor their creativity, we're both worried about that platform because we've been reading how white nationalists are using it to put propaganda in front of young white boys and radicalize them. So our boys are 9, but it's still stuff we're pretty worried about. So with that friend, she came over recently and taught me how to make a very delicious eggplant dish that I like to describe as like a streamlined eggplant parm. So you fry the eggplant in olive oil, but you don't bread it. And then you layer it with just like a little bit of crushed tomatoes, mozzarella, and parm, but you take a really light hand with the cheese, layer in fresh basil, and then bake it. And so it's somewhere in between like an eggplant parm and an eggplant confit. Oh my God, it's so good. And while we cooked, we discussed YouTube, among other things. And I gotta say, I'm so grateful for friends like that in this crazy world.
Me too, man. Friends are everything. And that eggplant dish sounds delicious.
So good.
I did make some big tomato and avocado sandwiches with lettuce and vegan mayo and salt on toasted bread for a big beach overlook picnic with a few friends this past weekend. So that was lovely. We brought chips and dip and just looked at the sea for a while. And I think it often is helpful to pull out of life for a moment. And those sandwiches let us take a moment to dream and appreciate our luck and opportunity, you know. But I also think just the fact that we're talking about race today will help us make things a little bit better, too. So let's get into the heart of the episode.
Yeah, I hope so. So let's do it. We're going to start with a little bit about our own backgrounds and how we perceive race. So why don't we dig in?
But before we do, can I just say that our understanding of ourselves and our race, its privileges, and more are evolving. So this episode marks what we're feeling in the fall of 2019. But I'm learning, and I'm expanding, and I'm growing, and I think Lee is too. So we know that this is an evolving narrative. And I just wanted to make that clear for folks.
Yeah, and I am with you. I mean, I really think the way we understand our own identities and the concept/construct of race, it will always evolve. But we're going to talk a little bit about our identities because I think it's important to put it in context.
Okay, so you start. Tell me a little bit about you.
Okay, so I am of Irish and French Canadian descent, Catholic on both sides. I grew up in an almost all white town on the south shore of Boston, parts of which are like unofficially called the Irish Riviera. My town is like the center of that. Now, Irish people have been there a long time as farmers, fishermen, Irish mossers, and the area for decades was where Irish people who were wanting to move out of Boston went. And that continued, maybe even intensified during white flight from the city during busing in the 70s and 80s. So I grew up in the 80s, rarely seeing people of color in person in my day-to-day or thinking about race at all. I think I was a pretty typical, well-meaning white person raised to be good to people, thinking I don't see color, not recognizing or checking my biases at all, not aware of my privilege as a white person at all, not aware of like how, while I never thought about race, I was receiving messages about being white and race all the time. You know, messages that help shape my worldview and my biases. And so that's a little bit about how my relationship to the idea of race was shaped. But so tell me about you. Tell me about your background as it relates to race.
So I'm a child of first and second generation immigrants. My mother was born in a poor mountain village just a few hours north of Tegucigalpa, Honduras. And she came to the USA in the late 60s and then promptly encouraged her family to emigrate as well. And my father's family hails from Naples, Italy, though he was born in the US. I grew up very much immersed within both Italian and Honduran culture, but my skin is very light, especially next to all my cousins. So people saw me as the white girl. I spent the first 14 years of my life in northern New Jersey, which is sort of like a melting pot of all sorts of people from different backgrounds. And we all met up at the malls or the grocery stores or the big city, mostly the malls. And black, white, and Spanish kids generally went to elementary school together. But I lived in an area of town that was more multicultural, and I was bused to a white middle school across town. I've lived on the East Coast, in the South, in the Midwest, where everyone saw me as white, and my mother was not at all white. She was dark-skinned, which was complicated, to say the least. You know, I was raised to love parts of my culture, and I was very much encouraged to assimilate to whiteness at a very young age to avoid the racism that my mother encountered in America, despite being an American citizen for like decades and decades. We generally lived with less from a socioeconomic perspective, but we had middle-class ambitions.
Yeah. Oh my God, that is so fascinating, Maggie. So this is like an uncomfortable question, but do you feel like you passed for white, like you had that privilege available to you?
Yes. I mean, I think the answer is yes. It was definitely called out to me a lot by some of my family members, too, who were darker than me. So I was aware of it. I've only truly woken up to my Latina culture in probably the last 10 years. And I can speak to the complexities of being an immigrant who has passed, both the privilege of that and the newly discovered shame that I wrestle with now.
Yeah.
You know, I benefited from the ability to pass as a white girl, and parts of me still identify as someone who is white. It was just easier for me to fit in and also have a seat at the table, like any table. And I also felt more equipped to defend myself and to defend my mother's culture and to hustle for what I deserved. But I benefited from my Latina culture too. Mm-hmm. You know, I spoke Spanish rather well. I still do. I need a little bit of time with my family to like get it back. But I speak Spanish really well. And I was often like the teacher's aide throughout high school, receiving honors and advanced curriculum. I also received scholarships and privileges for being a woman of color during college. You know, I wasn't a quote unquote like Caucasian non-Hispanic, but it was still complicated for me to tick off the Hispanic box on applications. It was true, but it wasn't the whole story.
Right.
Yeah. So what about you? We've talked a bit about the feeling of shame when it comes to waking up about race. Tell me sort of what you're feeling about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I've definitely felt shame, like when I have realized all of the unearned privileges I have accrued and feeling like I'm not doing enough about it. I've definitely felt ashamed that I'm part of a demographic where 51% of us voted for Donald Trump. That's like not cool with me.
No, it's weird.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. And, you know, I've about being an Irish American and knowing about the history of race relations in this city, like that's a lot. And part of what I've also learned is that if I'm wrestling with shame, I have to channel it somehow.
Yeah, I totally get that. But just like I think we need to sit with any feelings we have to work through, I think we need to sit with the shame, even if it's for just a little bit. Like, I feel like sitting with it humbles you and it rejiggers your path and it helps you decide what more you need to learn or unlearn and understand. And I think there are a lot of people in this country, frankly, who could benefit from sitting with a little shame, even for just a little while. And that time, I think, will allow you to become more critical, more observant. Maybe you can step out of yourself a little bit and witness the feeling so you can begin the learning, unlearning, and ultimately the healing, which is the healing for yourself and perhaps the healing for others as
right.
well.
Right. I agree. And I think you make a really good point about just acknowledging and naming your feeling and then sort of starting to unpack it. I sort of feel like I can't sit with it for a long time because I have sat with it in waves over the years. And like, I sort of want to be acting on it at the same time as I'm unpacking it in a way.
Totally. And I don't know that everyone has the ability to like sit with the shame and work on it at the same time. I think you need some time to just sit, to work through the feelings around it in order to learn and unlearn and then turn that responsibility into action.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally. So. There's like a meme I saw the other day where it's like, you've got yourself, you've got your understanding.
Yeah.
And then you've got putting that understanding into action. And sometimes between those two, it can take a while.
That's it. Right. That's it.
Yeah. But you said you've woken up to your heritage in like the past 10 years. So say more, because we've talked about this a bunch, you know, not on the air, but how are you making up for lost time? Like, how are you learning?
Yeah. I mean, I say it's 10 years, but I think I've always been looking for expanders and lessons on race since going to college and living on my own and getting out from under my parents' purview. You know, my learning started probably with the internet. It's really been my biggest expander. For a while after college, I worked for New York Online, which is a predominantly Black online community based in Brooklyn. And I was able to read and learn about their experience in that community. It was mostly writers and artists with amazing feelings and great ways to communicate that. So that was probably the beginning for me. Today, though, I follow people who exemplify like what I want to be in the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm still figuring out what I want to be in the world. But many of those people are women of color. I follow people who say things that are hard to say, hoping that I learn to understand those things and say them myself too, because I think things need to be a little uncomfortable. And I think I need to be able to find the strength to say some of those things.
Yep.
I'm making up for lost time by following the tough narratives and placing myself in them in some way to learn, grow, and expand. I happen also to be a community person, right? So I end up just putting myself out there more. And that's been a big way for me to make up for lost time. So I push myself to hang out in communities and regions where I might find other Hondurans or other people of color.
Mm-hmm.
I also recently figured out that, you know, I've had a life and I've done stuff. And many of the women who want to network with me are younger women of color. It surprised me at first. It took me a little bit to put that together.
And yeah.
I guess I shouldn't have taken me that long to be like, oh, take note of this. Wow. And while the conversations aren't always easy, because I'm pretty honest about my evolving awakening to race and my privilege, I search for a way to help them in big and small ways. And it's a privilege to be in a position to make an introduction or read something they've written. I am like figuring out ways to help, and they're definitely helping me too.
Yeah. I love that you're sort of just continuing to evolve.
Totally.
Yeah.
What about you? You've said that at some point, even after such a sort of racially homogeneous upbringing, you started to learn. How?
Yeah, well, so I went to college on the West Coast, also sort of got out of the context. But the college town where I lived was also pretty white, as was the population of my college for the most part. But the school, the Evergreen State College, is known for its progressive pedagogy, and many of the students and faculty there were like very political. So I ended up taking a lot of political theory and critical theory classes, and that's where I started thinking about race in any depth. And I remember this one amazing professor, she was a Black woman, and she introduced us to the idea of white privilege. I was like 19, and basically like my brain cracked open, and I was like, oh my God, all the ways I benefited without ever realizing it, you know? It was a big moment, but that was just the beginning. And it was also in an academic setting. So, well, it did crack open my brain. You know, I sort of just went on with my life.
Right.
But that planted the seed, really. So then I moved to the city, and I've lived here for 17 years. So it's not anything like growing up in my hometown in terms of the demographics, even though Boston's neighborhoods are pretty segregated. But so for many years, my life has not been racially isolated like it was when I was growing up. And there are people of color all around me. And my kids go to the Boston Public Schools, and their school is over 50% children of color.
Oh, that's great. I know you've mentioned their school as an important place where you've learned. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, totally. So their school is a space that forces me to check my privilege, check my biases, all of that very regularly, because it's just the demographics are, there's a minority white people and people from all socioeconomic backgrounds and many, many diverse cultures. And so I have to check myself all the time, and sort of it's allowed me to also be a witness to the kinds of just assumptions that myself or other white parents make. It's been really humbling. But I also say, like, it's been amazing for my kids to grow up in a setting where white people are not, like, necessarily seen as the center of the universe.
I think that's amazing, and they're so lucky.
Yeah, I do too. And I really have to tip my hat to the principal, who is like a committed anti-racist, and it's a great place. And it's a place where you can really see how race works in daily interactions between people, but also because it's a, you know, part of a large public institution, you start to get a firsthand look at how structural racism plays out. And that really lights a fire under your ass, or I'm speaking for myself. So I hope it helps to shape their worldview, you know, but I also kind of still see how the messages that they receive all around them still reinforces this like racial hierarchy with white people at the top. So it's a lot to push back at, you know? Anyway, so yes, I mean, school has been a big place where I've learned a lot about race, like very firsthand, but I also have to give credit to the internet, like you, and like the young Black activists whose voices there have really forced the dialogue about race in this country to evolve. So the Black Lives Matter movement, the people who are bringing up critiques of the Women's March, following a lot of those activists on social media, and absorbing media made from the point of view of people of color, just reading a lot, you know, in general, really trying to put myself in the listening seat as much as possible.
And I think that's super important, like getting into a position of real listening, like not just hearing, but listening and letting what's said affect you such that you decide to dig in even more, question your biases, learn. I think that's super powerful, and it's also a humbling place to be.
Yeah, and I mean, in general in life, not just around these topics, but just in general, I think we could all stand to do that a little bit more. But I'm curious, do you have specific people you like to listen to or follow, especially people who give you like distinct insight into your identity or your privilege or whatever it is?
Yes, I do. So I follow Rachel Cargill on Instagram. She's a Black writer on race who has about, I don't know, 300,000 followers. And I love that she says very hard stuff. And it's really hard.
Like, yeah.
And I listen and I learn. And she's at rachel.cargill on IG, if anyone's interested. I follow Jessamine Stanley. She's a Black yoga teacher with a few 100,000 followers, I think 400, 500. And she had a great piece in the New York Times on yoga, accessible yoga. She's My Name is Jessamine on IG. Then there's, of course, one of our favorites, Aminatou Sow. She's the host of the Call Your Girlfriend podcast. She has about 60,000 followers on her personal IG account, which is at Aminatou. She's amazing. And she calls things out. And then not exactly related, but Dana Falsetti. She's a white woman yoga teacher on IG with somewhere in the realm of 300,000 to 600,000 followers on all her accounts. She talks about race pretty solely on her Fat Daddy Vintage account now. She stopped it in other places. You know, I follow a lot of women with larger, abundant bodies. And while being larger is not an issue of race, fat people are marginalized in some similar ways. And I find that they have expanded way more than other white people. So I sort of surround myself with these women. And there's a bunch of other writers I follow, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah, same here. I follow all of the people you just mentioned, except I hadn't heard of Dana Falsetti and others, too. But I mean, it sounds like even though our backgrounds are pretty different, we're in a similar place of understanding, like, for myself, you know, I get it. I have a lot of unearned privilege because I'm a white person. I move through the world and my kids move through the world without a whole lot of hassle. And that fact like influences my choices about everything, about what industry I work in, the neighborhood I choose to live in, where I choose to take a vacation, what we do for fun, where I do it, all that stuff. Like whether I let my kids play with Nerf guns outside and so many more sort of mundane facts of life, you know? So I sort of get that to a point, but I'm always learning about the ways that I don't get it, you know, mm-hmm. which is why I appreciate people like Rachel Cargill
right.
being like, wait a minute. But the place where I struggle, I'll say, is like how I can be an ongoing ally an accomplice, right, to people of color. Like, when I was an editor, I made a project of telling more stories of people who are not white and of trying to find writers of color to write for me. You know, I'll show up at a protest. I'll do some work that helps with movement building. I definitely talk openly to my white children about race and privilege. But sometimes I feel like it isn't enough. So I'm always thinking about what is enough, you know?
Yeah, no, I know, completely. You know, I grew up as a little fighter, someone who defended my mother until the end and had to defend her all the time, you know, even just going to, like, I don't know, City Hall or the DMV to get a license. Like, I had to be there with her to help. And that fighting extended into my years in startup technology, where I was often the only woman at the table, and they didn't even know I was a Latina woman. And at that table, I fought and negotiated and defended and worked hard to get what I deserved compared to the men around me. You know, my father raised me to be as equal to any man, which has served me in many ways. But while I fought for my mother and me, I wasn't in situations where I could really fight for other Latin women, you know? And I feel sad about not recognizing my culture and for following the example of my parents who taught me to assimilate. So I'm in the middle of it all now, and I'm still sitting with those feelings, which I think is a good thing because, you know, I'm being able to sort of stand out and witness these things that I'm feeling and do something about it. But today I'm trying to figure out how I can make up for that. So how I can explore what it means to be a woman of Honduran descent in a time when many Hondurans are being stopped at the border and thrown into cages.
Right.
You know, like, I often wonder if I should be at the border, if I should use my privilege and go at the border and fight there versus at a conference room table.
Yeah. I mean, I feel the same way. I'm like, do I need to get in a car and drive to the border?
Right. Right.
You know,
I think perhaps the story is probably the story of other immigrant children raised in the 70s. You know, I'm not the only one that was encouraged to assimilate.
Right.
And as a woman is only starting to identify as a woman of color, I recognize my privilege of passing, but I also want to fight for the immigrant experience and help other women of color advance. And frankly, I think the internet, you know, and this podcast in particular, is a way I'll continue to explore how I can help in ways that matter.
Yeah, same here. I want to switch gears for a second. So I, you know, like I said earlier, we worked on this script for a long time and it's big stuff. I just, like, sometimes I wonder how we can explore it with, like, a little more levity, because I really hate taking myself so seriously. You know what I mean?
You know, it's hard. Like, it's hard when you wrote that, like when we talked about this, because I get what you're saying. And I think humor is important to this conversation, but it might not be in the way you think. Like, I think there's only a few places for humor. Like, if others want to make fun of white people, that is totally okay for me. But white people should not make fun of any other race, please.
No.
No. You know, I think every other race has been held down for centuries. So I definitely gravitate to comedians and jokesters who make fun of white people and their privilege. That's the place where I'm okay with it.
I agree. I mean, I'm not sitting here saying, like, I just want to make jokes about everybody, but I do really like to poke at whiteness. The more you can poke holes and laugh at it, the more that you can see that it is a made up thing, you know? But I could go on and on about that. Jokes about white people. Okay, start. So I listened to this podcast the other day called Small Doses with Amanda Seales. She's a comedian. And the episode was called The Side Effects of White Women. The Side Effects of White Women.
She might start laughing at any moment because this podcast was actually super funny.
It was funny. And it was all about how white people need to get with the program and use their privilege to challenge the status quo. So she did it well because she was able to bring levity to it. But at the same time, she brought up a lot of really interesting points, about one of which was, got me thinking a lot about how white people need to consider their heritage more. So, I mean, she was saying, like, take a minute to think where you came from, because Americans all came from immigrants. Some of us were just more welcome to assimilate than others. And I started to think about it, and I was like, yeah, I mean, growing up, I was never really taught about my heritage so much, like a little bit, but it wasn't an emphasis. Like, we didn't celebrate St. Patrick's Day more than anybody else, you know. So one side of my family had people who came over because of the potato famine in Ireland, and the other side were, for the most part, like, very early French colonists in Canada who then emigrated south to the U.S. So I don't really know a ton more than that. But even that, like, underscores the fact that immigration, just like the United States, we are a country of immigrants.
Totally. But to be honest, like, just hearing what you just said, it also just sort of, like, blows me away when like white people don't know more about their backgrounds.
Yeah.
Like, sure, we're all Americans by birth, but none of us originated on this land.
Correct.
This is a super young country, and the original Americans were Native Americans. Like, none of us came from this land. And I think I agree with the podcast you mentioned. Like, I think I heard her say something like, not acknowledging your background or ancestry, however distant, is also a type of racism. Mm. And I so stand for that. Now, it may be easy for me to say, since my ancestry was very apparent to me, since the immigration was so recent. But still, I mean, still, I think there should have been a construct that forces all people, including people who are white-skinned or identify as white, to know more about their backgrounds, recognize and acknowledge. And I think we may all be way more invested in fixing our racial issues if some of that happened. You know, if we agree that we're all immigrants, like if we can all just say we are all immigrants, even if the immigration happened 300 years ago, then maybe these racial issues may be less prevalent, or we just be having different problems. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, because I do, again, like, race was created to divide us so that people could accrue more power. So I don't know that even if we went through that exercise, we would get anywhere in terms of the racial problems that we have. But as I was thinking about it, and when we were talking about it, when you do go through that exercise, you're like, yeah, first of all, white people should do this, because it gets you thinking. Like, right. For example, some of my ancestors came here because they were starving, just like a lot of people who are trying to come to America right now. And once again, like, it just serves as a reminder that race is made up.
Yeah. And I think I'm probably oversimplifying the issue. There are people that are way smarter than me who've done lots of research that may have been able to figure out what could have been different if. But whether your immigration was a generation ago or 10 generations ago, I think you should know it and understand it.
To remember that just because, I don't know, it's like, just because you're white doesn't divest you of your background.
Right.
And whatever struggle happened in the past.
Right.
So I know that you are in the midst of learning and embracing your immigrant background. So I'm curious to hear, what's something you've learned about your Honduran background that's resonated or made you want to fight even more for other women of color?
Yeah, I think, well, I'm glad you asked me this, because in the last 10 years, I have learned a lot more about how similar I am to my mother, my grandmother, my great-grandmother, and my descendants. You know, my mother was the host with the most. She was always gathering people to help them shine. Mm. And she actually wanted to come to the U.S. to be a star, but also to have a little boutique.
Oh.
She said that she wanted to do those two things simultaneously. My grandmother was similar. She started churches in Honduras, and she was running retail spaces or general stores down there. My family called them servicitas, or helpful little spots. And she was bringing people in and helping them improve or simply get access to food and goods. You know, I think community beyond blood is essential to the Hondurans I know. You know, family is critical, but the circle is very, very wide with the Hondurans I know. And they include neighbors and friends. And that's helped me understand more about why community has been a theme in my work, and how I could create communities not just to advance all women, but specifically women of color.
Mm.
You know, it's secured my commitment to help women expand in a gathering sort of way, or the way that I can.
I love that. I mean, isn't it cool to sort of know, to be able to have that thread about who came before you?
It's the best.
So, listeners, please email us at madefreshpodcast@gmail.com. to tell us what you think about when you think about race and immigration and all of the stuff that we talked about today. And maybe we'll do an update to this episode featuring your stories.
Hello, Maggie here.
Hey, and this is Lee. So someday we'll have ads to read with so much love featured in this podcast. But until then, we're just going to make our own ads for ourselves.
I love it. Go, Lee.
No, you go.
Okay, I'll go first. So I'd love to tell you about my new cookbook. It's called A New Way to Food, and it's a cookbook that's filled with over 100 recipes, many of which are plant-based, and a bunch of essays on my wellness transformation from lifelong dieter to just happy-to-be-me lady. It's packed with full-color photos and a lot of honest thoughts on how it feels to be well and big in this universe. So I'd love for you to pick up a copy wherever you buy your favorite cookbooks, and maybe that's an indie bookstore. My favorite is the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Mass.
Oh, I love that store. And I love your book. Oh, I have to say, this is my plug for Maggie's book. It's excellent. You should pick it up. So I also have a book. It came out a year ago. It's called My Kitchen Chalkboard. And my book is A Year of Seasonal Family Recipes. So there are 16 seasonal menus that take you through the entire year with a lot of tips and talking about meal planning, batch cooking, and other ways you can streamline your efforts in the kitchen to make mealtime come together more simply.
And where can they get it?
So people can find it anywhere books are sold. I will tell you about my favorite indie bookstore, which is Paper Cuts JP in Jamaica Plain. But it's available everywhere.
Awesome. Well, that was easy. I'll read ads forever with you. In some episodes, we want to dig in and share how we do what we do. And in this one, we're going to talk a little bit about the dishes from our descendants, from our background, because it all comes down to food, too, at the table, not just these tough conversations. So let's talk a little bit about our foods.
Okay. So my mom was very good with potatoes. I mean, just saying. So there is this one dish that she used to make every single year growing up. And I make versions of it, but it's essentially like a potato gratin on steroids.
Oh, wow.
It's you rice the potatoes. Mm-hmm. And then you combine them with like every dairy product known to man. Sour cream, heavy cream, and cheddar cheese.
Oh, my goodness.
And then you bake them in the oven for, I mean, they're extremely sturdy and extremely rich and comforting. And we probably have them now once a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Potatoes were tough when I, you know, joined my husband's Irish American family. I have a tough relationship with potatoes.
They wouldn't let you touch the potatoes.
They wouldn't let me make the potatoes. Everybody else could. I think I did it once at one of the early gatherings, and Don was just being so sweet. And yeah, I'm just not the person to make the potatoes.
And then afterwards, he was like, never again. Okay.
Yeah. It's okay. I got schooled. It was fine.
Funny.
For me, I would say, you know, the predominant dishes that got carried through are beans and rice independently and together. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always a pot of black beans on the stove, always. And, you know, my mother might reheat that in the morning and like poach an egg in the broth and eat that for breakfast or a snack or anything. Mm-hmm. And there was always rice on the stove too. And it was usually orange tinted rice, saffron rice, or rice with achiote in it. Mm-hmm. And I had a complicated relationship with rice. It was always there, but it was limited to me, again, because of being the big girl. So I hated rice for many, many years. It's only now in recent years that I've come back to rice and I've found ways to love it and enjoy it. And I put a recipe in my latest cookbook that's a different kind of orange rice that makes me happy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Beans and rice are a staple.
They really are.
Yeah. Okay, so the Fresh Collects is where we go on and on about the stuff that lights us up. Just a couple things we're really excited about right now.
So can I talk a little bit about Texas?
Mm-hmm.
I was there on my tour for my first cookbook and did some events in Houston and in Dallas. Gosh, I love Houston. But I was totally immersed with Latin people and it was wonderful.
Yeah,
I'm excited to support RACES, which is the Refugee and Immigration Center for Education and Legal Services, which is based down there. They're a nonprofit group that provides free and low-cost legal services to underserved immigrants. They believe that no person is illegal and that refugees are supposed to come to the United States. Mm-hmm. That's what we founded this country on.
Right.
And they're committed to people, not parties. They're a big supporter of Central American refugees, so I'm learning a lot about them and giving them my money.
Yeah, so along those lines, I'm like a little bit obsessed with the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is a nonprofit organization based in Alabama. And their mission is to basically take down hate groups through legal services. So they do a lot now, you know, they're very busy because there are a lot of hate groups.
There's a lot of stuff going on.
And so they have this, they just do a lot of really powerful work uncovering, you know, white nationalism and all of this and domestic terrorism and all of this stuff. So I give them money.
Another thing that I collect that I love is podcasts by women of color. And there's one called The Brown Girl Pod. It's a podcast dedicated to telling the stories of brown women, and it's at Brown Girl Pod on Instagram if you want to find it. They are challenging the single narrative and creating a space that is open, inclusive, and diverse, and you can listen to them on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. I like these stories because they're about what regular people are doing, and as a body of work, the stories of women of color are special and important and unique and powerful altogether. They tell a story of progress and equality, and I'm really into it.
Awesome. I'm going to listen. So I have a couple books of fiction to recommend, I guess. One is The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead, which came out in 2016 from the point of view of an escaped slave who's a young woman and her odyssey trying to escape. It's just an amazing story. And then the other book I'm reading right now is called, this came out last year, and I just checked it out of the library. It's called An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. And this one's about a young black married couple in Atlanta and how this one thing that happens where the husband is falsely accused of a crime that he didn't commit changes their entire lives. And there's a line where the father-in-law says about his son-in-law, he basically is a victim of America. It's powerful, but it's also a very absorbing love story. It's a great read.
Oh, I'm going to get it then.
Yeah, it's good.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you on the next episode of Made Fresh.
Until then, you can follow me, Lee, at Miss Lee B on Instagram, and Maggie at Ms. Maggie B on Instagram.
And if you like this podcast, please rate it and recommend it, because your opinion matters to us and to others who are looking for great, fresh content.
Okay, bye for now. We'll talk to you soon.